Mr. Herman.
Poop again! Party on, dudes!
Welcome back in to the Radcast, everybody. I'm Steven, and I just want to catch you here right at the beginning to let you know what you've already probably seen. This is a special bonus episode, one of two bonuses that is coming out of our recording session with our sister Samantha when we all got together to talk about The Princess Bride, which released right before this episode that you're listening to now. This is a bit of an addendum to the episode proper, to where we really dive in to the characters of Inigo Montoya and Fezzik. Samantha, what you're about to hear is Samantha takes a little bit to read from The Princess Bride, the novel, kind of Inigo's backstory to kind of flesh out the character as a whole, and we take whatever she reads, however the book fleshes them out, and we kind of compare that to the screen depiction. So from page to screen is what this bonus is called, and we're really highlighting Fezzik and Inigo in this particular bonus episode. So I won't keep you waiting. We had a great time as a whole in the 3 hours plus we were recording for this episode. You'll be getting the next bonus episode after this one. So at the time that I'm recording this and the time that it's released, so New Year's Day, you will get the final bonus episode that came from this recording session. So I won't keep you any longer. Here is our specific discussion about the characters of Inigo Montoya and Fezzik from page to screen.
And it can't be over like that.
Speaking of great lines, like when they're doing it, you know, obviously Fezzini and Fezzik and Inigo, like they kidnapped Buttercup, which we felt was set up by the prince, but we don't know that at the time.
Right.
Mm. And basically, like, you Dread Pirate Roberts, the man in black, who's Wesley, is following them. And you get the whole sort. It sets up the fencing scene. But, like, Inigo loves the sport of it, like, of fighting. And so he's like, you know, I want to give this man a sporting chance. I'm going to fight with my left hand. Because it just would be too quick if I fought with my right, because I'm the best. Like, I've been doing this too long. And so, like, they're fighting, and as they're getting mutual respect for each other, he's like, I have something I need to tell you. He's like, I am not left-handed. And then, like, and then he switches to the right, and then Wesley's like, I have something I have to tell you too. I'm not left-handed either. And so you're just like, oh, that's so good.
It's so great. So right here, can we take a pause? I'm going to read to you Inigo's backstory.
Yes.
Leave it in, take it out. It
no,
doesn't
please.
Matter.
Yeah.
Well, because it might, you know, it's not super long on paper, but it might be longer. So
No, we'll figure it out.
So I'll start a couple paragraphs up. He stood now, quickly jumping to his feet, his blade-thin body ready for action. Only the man in black was still many feet away. There was nothing to do but wait for him. Inigo hated waiting. So to make the time more pleasant, he pulled from the scabbard his great, his only love, the six-fingered sword. How it danced in the moonlight, how glorious and true. Inigo brought it to his lips, and with all the fervor in his great Spanish heart, kissed the metal. Now, this starts Inigo, the backstory. In the mountains of central Spain, set high in the hills above Toledo, was the village of Arabella. It was very small, and the air was always clear. That was all you could say that was good about Arabella. Terrific air. You could see for miles. But there was no work. The dogs overran the streets, and there was never enough food. The air, clear enough, was also too hot in the daylight, freezing at night. As to Inigo's personal life, he was always just a trifle hungry. He had no brothers or sisters, and his mother had died in childbirth. He was fantastically happy because of his father. Domingo Montoya was funny-looking and crotchety and impatient and absent-minded and never smiled. Inigo loved him. Totally. Don't ask why. There really wasn't any one reason you could put your finger on. Oh, probably Domingo loved him back, but love is many things, none of them logical. Domingo Montoya made swords. If you wanted a fabulous sword, did you go to Domingo Montoya? If you wanted a great, balanced piece of work, did you go to the mountains behind Toledo? If you wanted a masterpiece, a sword for the ages, was it Arabella that your footsteps led you to? Nope. You went to Madrid, because Madrid was where lived the famous Yeste, and if you had the money and he had the time, you got your weapon. Yeste was fat and jovial and one of the richest and most honored men in the city. And he should have been. He made wonderful swords, and noblemen bragged to each other when they owned an original Yeste. But sometimes, not often, mind you, maybe once a year, maybe less, a request would come in for a weapon that was more than even Yeste could make. When that happened, did Yeste say, "Alas, I am sorry, I cannot do it"? Nope. What he said was, "Of course, I'd be delighted. 50% down payment, please. The rest before delivery. Come back in a year. Thank you very much." The next day, he would set out for the hills behind Toledo. "So, Domingo," Yeste would call out when he reached Inigo's father's hut. "So, Yeste," Domingo Montoya would return from the hut doorway. Then the two men would embrace, and Inigo would come running up, and Yeste would rumple his hair, and then Inigo would make tea while the two men talked. "I need you," Yeste would always begin. Domingo would grunt. "This very week, I have accepted a commission to make a sword for a member of the Italian nobility. It is to be jewel-encrusted at the handle, and the jewels are to spell out the name of his present mistress and..." No. That single word and that alone. But it was enough. When Domingo Montoya said no, it meant nothing else but. Inigo, busy with the tea, knew what would happen now. Yeste would use his charm. No. Yeste would use his wealth. No. His wit, his wonderful gift for persuasion. No. He would beg, entreat, promise, pledge. No. Insults, threats. No. Finally, genuine tears. No. More tea, Yeste? Perhaps another cup, thank you. Then a big, "Why won't you?" Inigo hurried to refill their cups so as to never miss a word. He knew they had been brought up together, had known each other 60 years, had never not loved one another deeply, and it thrilled him when he could hear them arguing. That was the strange thing. Arguing was all they ever did. "Why? My fat friend asks me why. He sits there on his world-class ass and has the nerve to ask me why? Yeste, come to me sometime with a challenge. Once, just once, ride up and say, 'Domingo, I need a sword for an 80-year-old man to fight a duel.' And I would embrace you and cry, 'Yes,' because to make a sword for an 80-year-old man to survive a duel, that would be something. Because the sword would have to be strong enough to win, yet light enough not to tire his weary arm. I would have to use all my all to perhaps find an unknown metal, strong but very light, or devise a different formula for a known one, mix some bronze with some iron and some air in a way ignored for thousands of years. I would kiss your smelly feet for an opportunity like that, fat Yeste. But to make a stupid sword with stupid jewels in the form of stupid initials to some stupid Italian can thrill his stupid mistress, no, that I will not do. For the last time, I ask you, please, for the last time, I tell you, I am sorry, no. I gave my word the sword would be made, Yeste said. I cannot make it. In all the world, no one but can but you. And you say no. Which means I have gone back on a commitment. Which means I have lost my honor. Which means that since honor is the only thing in the world I care about, and since I cannot live without it, I must die. And since you are my dearest friend, I may as well die now with you, basking in the warmth of your affection." And here Yeste would pull out a knife It was a magnificent thing, a gift from Domingo on Yeste's wedding day. Goodbye, little Inigo, Yeste would say then. God grant you your quota of smiles. It was forbidden for Inigo to interrupt. Goodbye, little Domingo, Yeste would say then. Although I die in your hut, and although it is your own stubborn fault that causes my ceasing. In other words, even though you are killing me, don't think twice about it. I love you as I always have, and God forbid your conscience should give you any trouble. He pulled open his coat, brought the knife closer, closer. The pain is worse than I imagined, Yeste cried. How can it hurt when the point of the weapon is still an inch away from your belly? Domingo said. I'm anticipating. Don't bother me. Let me die unpestered. He brought the point to his skin and pushed. Domingo grabbed the knife away. Someday, I won't stop you, he said. Inigo set an extra place for supper. I was all set to kill myself, truly. Enough dramatics. What is on the menu this evening? The usual gruel. Inigo, go check and see if there's anything by chance in my carriage outside. There was always a feast waiting in the carriage. And after the food and the stories would come the departure. And always before the departure would come the request. We could be partners, yes, you would say, in Madrid. My name before yours on the sign, of course, but equal partners in all things. No. All right, your name before mine. You are the greatest swordmaker. You deserve to come first. Have a good trip back. Why won't you? Because, my friend Yeste, you are very famous and very rich, and so you should be. Because you make wonderful weapons, but you must also make them for any fool who happens along. I am poor, and no one knows me in all the world except you and Inigo. But I do not have to suffer fools. You are an artist, Yeste said. No, not yet. A craftsman only. But I dream to be an artist. I pray that someday, if I work with enough care, if I am very, very lucky, I will make a weapon that is a work of art. Call me an artist then, and I will answer. Yeste entered his carriage. Domingo approached the window and whispered, I remind you only of this. When you get this jeweled initialed sword, claim it as your own. Tell no one of my involvement. Your secret is safe with me. Embraces and waves the carriage would leave, and that was the way of life before the six-fingered sword. Inigo remembered exactly the moment it began. He was making lunch for them. His father always, from the time he was six, let him do the cooking, when a heavy knocking came on the hut door. Inside there, a voice boomed. Be quick about it. Inigo's father opened the door. Your servant, he said. You are a sword maker, came the booming voice. Of distinction, I have heard that this is true. If only it were, Domingo replied, but I have no great skills. Mostly I do repair work. Perhaps if you had a dagger blade that was dulling, I might be able to please you. But anything more is beyond me. Inigo crept up behind his father and peeked out. The booming voice belonged to a powerful man with dark hair and broad shoulders, who sat upon an elegant brown horse. A nobleman, clearly, but Inigo could not tell the country. I desire to have made for me the greatest sword since Excalibur. I hope your wishes are granted, Domingo said. And now, if you please, our lunch is almost ready, and I do not give you permission to move. You stay right exactly where you are, or risk my wrath, which, I must tell you in advance, is considerable. My temper is murderous. Now, what were you saying about your lunch? I was saying that it will be hours before it is ready. I have nothing to do and would not dream of budging. There are rumors, the nobleman said, that deep in the hills behind Toledo lives a genius, the greatest sword maker in all the world.
He visits here sometimes. That must be your mistake. But his name is Yeste, and he lives in Madrid. I will pay 500 pieces of gold for my desires, said the big-shouldered nobleman. That is more money than all the men in this village will earn in all their lives, said Domingo. Truly, I would love to accept your offer, but I am not the man you seek. These rumors lead me to believe that Domingo Montoya would solve my problem. What is your problem? I am a great swordsman, but I cannot find a weapon to match my peculiarities, and therefore I am deprived of reaching my highest skills. If I had a weapon to match my peculiarities, there would be no one in the world equal to me. And what are these peculiarities you speak of? The nobleman held up his right hand. Domingo began to grow excited. The man had six fingers. You see, the nobleman began. Of course, Domingo interrupted. The balance of the sword is wrong for you, because every balance has been conceived of for five. The grip of every handle cramps you, because it has been built for five. For an ordinary swordsman, it would not matter, but a great swordsman, a master, would have eventual discomfort. And the greatest swordsman in the world must always be at ease. The grip of his weapon must be as natural as the blink of his eye and cause him no more thought. Clearly, you understand the difficulties, the nobleman began again. But Domingo had traveled where others' words could never reach him. Inigo had never seen his father so frenzied. The measurements, of course, each finger and the circumference of the wrist and the distance from the sixth nail to the index pad. So many measurements. And your preferences. Do you prefer to slash or to cut? If you slash, do you prefer the right to the left movement or perhaps the parallel? When you cut, do you enjoy an upward thrust? And how much power do you wish to come from the shoulder? How much from the wrist? And do you wish your opponent coated so as to enter more easily? Or do you enjoy seeing your opponents wince? So much to be done, so much to be done. And on he went until the noble dismounted and had to almost take him by the shoulders to quiet him. You are the man of the rumors. Domingo nodded. And you will make me the greatest sword since Excalibur. I will beat my body to ruins for you, and perhaps I will fail, but no one will try harder. And payment? When you get the sword, then payment. Now let me get to work measuring. Inigo, my instruments. Inigo scurried into the darkest corner of the hut. I insist on leaving something on account. It is not necessary. I may fail. I insist. All right, one gold piece. Leave that, but do not bother me with money when there is work that needs beginning. The noble took out one piece of gold. Domingo put it in a drawer and left it without even a glance. Feel your fingers now, he commanded. Rub your hands hard. Shake your fingers. You will be excited when you duel, and this handle must match your hand in the excitement. If I measured when you were relaxed, there would be a difference, as much as a thousandth of an inch, and that would rob us of perfection. And that is what I seek, perfection. I will not rest for less. The nobleman had to smile. And how long will it take to reach it? Come back in a year, Domingo said, and with that, he set to work. Such a year. Domingo slept only when he dropped from exhaustion. He ate only when Inigo would force him to. He studied, fretted, complained. He never should have taken the job. It was impossible. The next day, he would be flying. He never should have taken the job. It was too simple to be worth his labors. Joy to despair, day to day, hour to hour. Sometimes Inigo would wake to find him weeping. What is it, father? It is that I cannot do it. I cannot make the sword. I cannot make my hands obey me. I would kill myself, except what would you do then? Go to sleep, father. No, I don't need sleep. Failures don't need sleep. Anyway, I slept yesterday. Please, father, a little nap. All right, a few minutes to keep you from nagging. And some nights, Inigo would wake to see him dancing. What is it, father? It is that I have found my mistakes, corrected my misjudgments. Then it will be done soon, father? It will be done tomorrow, and it will be a miracle. You are wonderful, father. I'm more wonderful than wonderful. How dare you insult me? But the next night, more tears. What is it now, Father? The sword, I cannot make the sword. But last night, Father, you said you had found your mistakes. I was mistaken. Tonight I found new ones, worse ones. I am the most wretched of creatures. Say you wouldn't mind it if I killed myself so I could end this existence. But I would mind, Father. I love you, and I would die if you stopped breathing. You don't really love me. You're only speaking pity. Who would pity the greatest sword maker in the history of the world? Thank you, Inigo. You're welcome, Father. I love you back, Inigo. Sleep, Father. Yes, sleep. A whole year of that. A year of the handle being right, but the balance being wrong. Of the balance being right, but the cutting edge too dull. Of the cutting edge sharpened, but then that threw the balance off again. Of the balance returning, but now the point was fat. Of the point regaining its sharpness, only now the entire blade was too short, and it all had to go. All had to be thrown out. All had to be done again. 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 Domingo's health began to leave him. He was fevered always now, but he forced his frail shell on because this had to be the finest since Excalibur. Domingo was battling legend, and it was destroying him. Such a year. Then one night, Inigo woke to find his father seated, staring, calm. Inigo followed the stare. The six-fingered sword was done. Even in the hut's darkness, it glistened. At last, Domingo whispered. He could not take his eyes from the glory of the sword. After a lifetime, Inigo, I am an artist. The big-shouldered man did not agree. When he returned to purchase the sword, he merely looked at it a moment. Not worth waiting for, he said. Inigo stood in the corner of the hut, watching, holding his breath. You are disappointed? Domingo could scarcely get the words spoken. I'm not saying it's trash, you understand, the nobleman went on, but it's certainly not worth 500 pieces of gold. I'll give you 10. It's probably worth that. Wrong! Domingo cried. It's not worth 10. It is not worth even 1. Here! And he threw open the drawer where the 1 gold piece had lain untouched the year. The gold is yours, all of it. You have lost nothing. He took back the sword and turned away. I'll take the sword, the nobleman said. I didn't say I wouldn't take it. I only said I would pay what it is worth. Domingo whirled back, eyes bright. You quibbled. You haggled. Art was involved, and you saw only money. Beauty was here for the taking, and you saw only your fat purse. You have lost nothing. There is no more reason for you remaining here. Please go. The sword, the nobleman said. The sword belongs to my son, Domingo said. I give it to him now. It is forever his. Goodbye. You're a peasant and a fool, and I want my sword. You're an enemy of art, and I pity your ignorance, Domingo said. They were the last words he ever uttered. The nobleman killed him then, with no warning, a flash of the nobleman's sword, and Domingo's heart was torn to pieces. Inigo screamed. He could not believe it. It had not happened. He screamed again. His father was fine. Soon they would have tea. He could not stop screaming. The village heard. 20 men were at the door. The nobleman pushed his way through them. That man attacked me. See, he holds a sword. He attacked me, and I defended myself. Now move from my way. It was lies, of course, and everyone knew it. But he was a noble, so what was there to do? They parted, and the nobleman mounted his horse. Coward! The nobleman whirled. Pig! Again, the crowd parted. Inigo stood there, holding the six-fingered sword, repeating his words. Coward! Pig! Killer! Someone tend the babe before he oversteps himself, the noble said to the crowd. Inigo ran forward then.
standing in front of the nobleman's horse, blocking the nobleman's path. He raised the six-fingered sword with both his hands and cried, "I, Inigo Montoya, do challenge you, coward, pig, killer, ass, fool, to battle. Get him out of my way. Move the infant." "The infant is 10 and he stays," Inigo said. "Enough of your family is dead for one day. Be content," said the noble. "When you beg me for your breath, then I shall be contented. Now dismount." The nobleman dismounted. "Draw your sword." The nobleman unsheathed his killing weapon. "I dedicate your death to my father," Inigo said. "Begin." They began. It was no match, of course. Inigo was disarmed in less than a minute. But for the first 15 seconds or so, the noble was uneasy. During those 15 seconds, strange thoughts crossed his mind, for even at the age of 10, Inigo's genius was there. Disarmed, Inigo stood very straight. He said not a word, begged nothing. "I am not going to kill you," the nobleman said, "because you have talent and you're brave. But you're also lacking in manners, and that's going to get you in trouble if you're not careful. So I shall help you as you go through life by leaving you with a reminder that bad manners are to be avoided." And with that, his blade flashed 2 times. And Inigo's face began to bleed. 2 rivers of blood poured from his forehead to his chin, 1 crossing each cheek. And everyone watching knew it then. The boy was scarred for life. Inigo would not fall. The world went white behind his eyes, but he would not go to ground. The blood continued to pour. The nobleman replaced his sword, remounted, and rode on. It was only then that Inigo allowed the darkness to claim him. And there's more yeah. after that about everything he goes through, and he becomes, you know, alcoholic because he has all this time where he can't. Mm-hmm. He thinks he's going to find his father's killer quickly, and then he doesn't. And then Vizzini basically saves him from a life as a drunkard.
I really like that, because with a book, it of course affords you more time to flesh out character stories by fleshing out the characters within their backstory.
Yeah. So we get really more, explore the depth of that character.
We get more of a thought into more of a look into Domingo Montoya's his attitude towards his work, how he's not just going to be flippant and do it for money. He's going to do it for purpose.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was something that Inigo, who, although, you know, his father never smiled or never gave him any physical or verbal affirmation.
There's this absolute devotion. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But there's this devotion because, if anything, his father holds his morals to a higher standard, and he's not a sellout. So Inigo, since a young age, has respected that.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that contributes to his love for his father. Mm-hmm. So it makes it more tragic that Domingo puts up so much of an effort to really put his all into this art, but you have to deal with, he essentially, in a way, kind of has to sell himself out, even though it's a challenge to make the six-finger sword, and that's what he wants, is the challenge.
The artistic challenge.
Yeah. But he kind of, in a way, has to sell himself out because it's to a nobleman who's going to pay him a lot, but the challenge is more, so that's why he's putting all his work into it. So that's why he's furious when the merits to his art are not seen. And it's just, it makes it more tragic, his death, but it also makes it much more beautiful at the end when, in the book and in the movie, Inigo finally gets his revenge. Yeah. And then it also, it's a testament to how it was adapted in the screenplay.
I was literally just about to say
because
the same thing.
William Goldman's writing is definitely, he picked out what would help summarize it for a movie, but Mandy Patinkin's conviction,
he just absolutely sells it as, well, I don't know if he read the book or not. It's Mandy Patinkin, so he, I'm sure he read it and really looked in Inigo's backstory.
Yeah.
And he, without words, he's able to convey the kind of just crushing pain and agony that Inigo felt and feels and carries with him about his father's you know, murder at the mm-hmm. hands of the six-fingered man, which yeah. later we find out is Count Rugen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I'm sitting here, it actually kind of, I wonder if there wasn't quite a bit of, I wonder if William Goldman maybe saw
mm-hmm.
himself in, I wouldn't know this, just knowing kind of like his attitudes towards right. Hollywood, but mm-hmm. the fact that he was a pretty prolific screenwriter,
mm-hmm.
I wonder if maybe, you know, there isn't some of that, some of him in Domingo.
Right.
Of
sure.
like,
yeah. Yeah.
Hey, mm-hmm. I created this art and you just are treating it like garbage because you're money is
yeah,
what you're thinking
exactly.
of.
Yeah.
And so,
which I think is great because it contributes to his protection of his
the
most
Princess
famous
Bride.
Writing, mm-hmm. The Princess Bride, yeah. and why he's
his favorite.
His, yeah. his absolute his... favorite. So that's why I think it comes through. It kind of art imitates life in
mm-hmm.
the fact that he was so protective over this.
I think it's his six-fingered sword.
Yeah. yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is the Princess Bride movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know?
For sure.
And that's why the movie adaptation is so great
mm-hmm.
because as you were reading that, it was, I could visually see all of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And it's one of those things to where when you, I could then draw it back to the movie. And when you watch the movie,
mm.
it's done so well,
mm-hmm.
like in a more concise way,
right.
not to imply that it's all over the place.
Well, mm-hmm. it's a different medium.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
exactly.
he knew how to take his work of one medium
yeah.
while still retaining it
yeah.
and put it into another movie.
Oh, yeah. But you get, like, Inigo's motivation in the movie is so, it's so well portrayed
mm-hmm.
that it doesn't leave you saying, like, well, I have more questions about this, and what about
yeah.
this, and what about this? And just listening to that, it
mm-hmm.
just, it starts to just become more three-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
you're like, oh, okay, I'm getting enough of the backstory now to
yeah.
where, you know, this wasn't in the movie. A lot of
mm-hmm.
that's not in the movie, but I don't feel like, oh, that needed to
but
be
I
in there.
But I feel like
this,
it
yeah.
is in the movie, even though it's not.
Right.
Like, he
right.
does such a good job,
mm-hmm.
and Mandy Patinkin does such a good job that you're just like, it's like that's totally present in
yeah.
him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, in his portrayal.
In his portrayal, and then also just well-written exposition
mm.
can
mm.
say so much.
Yeah.
And that's what William Goldman did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, it's how it was delivered by Mandy Patinkin.
Yeah.
So it's so great because you can be satisfied enough with
mm.
the book and its portrayal
mm-hmm.
yeah.
of Inigo,
mm-hmm.
but you can also be satisfied with
yeah.
movie Inigo
yeah.
without knowing anything about
yeah,
what's
exactly.
Well, and I feel like even though I've had both,
mm-hmm.
I am satisfied with both of them.
Yeah.
yeah.
Like if they never made another Princess Bride movie, that's fine.
Right.
With me. Like I don't, if this is all like bonus cherry on the sundae, like.
Sure.
It's not, that's the kind of the miracle of his skill was like you, though there is a lot that's left out, you don't feel like there's anything missing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like he still manages to translate. So like one of the things I just really like a lot, and it's totally not, like if I were him, I would have left it out of the movie too.
Yeah.
But there's this whole first chapter where it's, so they go a bigger deal about how Buttercup is the most beautiful woman in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And they lead up to it by like, the year Buttercup was born, the most beautiful woman in the world
yeah.
was this woman. And she was a French parlor maid and the Duke's wife was jealous. And so she put candy everywhere in the house and the beautiful parlor maid got
yeah.
fat
mm-hmm.
and married the baker and like, you know, but you know, so there's like kind of like these fun tongue in cheek things that I don't even know if they further the story. I wouldn't want them to go though. Like
yeah,
sure.
I love them. Or there's like a lot of stuff about Buttercup's not interested in being beautiful. She's not interested in
mm-hmm.
boys. She's not interested in bathing.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Like her parents give her a hard time about how much she smells and
yeah.
how filthy she is. And then the author is like, but despite all that, she's in the top 20 based on potential and like
yeah.
just all this really wonderful stuff that's a very distinctive voice to Bill Goldman.
Mm-hmm.
And I, like, yeah, if I was making a movie, that stuff would go sure. as well, because mm-hmm. it's a tough enough movie to right. sell in 1986.
Yeah.
I love
but I'm glad it's
yeah.
there.
Yeah. yeah. Do they even mention briefly, like, Buttercup's parents in the
yes.
movie? Or is, okay.
Oh, in the movie, no.
No, yeah. she's just, all it said is that she lived on a farm, and Wesley yeah. was the farm boy.
Yeah, and I say, yeah, like, I've never it. Seen it before. Of yeah. course, I've seen it, right. but I don't remember. Yeah. Maybe
no, there's no mention
catch.
Of parents.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or,
but I love...
They really focus on the in-between.
Yeah.
I love...
You know.
We could also talk about... Inigo's partner, Fezzik.
Oh, man.
Who we've referenced already
Runaway,
a few times,
like,
with Andre the Giant.
Easily, for a lot of people, the
yeah.
best part of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Just given right. just the charm.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly the sheer size, he
yeah.
draws you in. Mm-hmm. But he's so, like, charming and likable.
Mm.
And, mm-hmm. and there's so many classic moments that involve Fezzik.
There's so many. He's so sweet and charming.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, some of my favorite lines... And he's so gentle. Like, some of us, like, you just move your finger. That's wonderful.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Like,
so
when,
sweet.
When they're
yeah.
outside of Humperdinck's castle
yes.
and Wesley comes
yeah.
back to life, he's like, you're moving your head. That doesn't make you happy.
yes.
And Wesley's like, my brains, his steel, your strength against 60 men. You think a little head movement would make me happy?
Head jiggle?
And
a
he's like,
head jiggle makes
then,
me happy.
And then but then Wesley goes,
it's so good.
And Fezzik is just smiling.
Oh, my God. So my favorite story ever, I was driving. You know which one I'm talking about,
yep.
where they talk about how it took them forever to actually shoot that scene.
Mm-hmm.
Because on the first take, apparently Andre the Giant's farts were, like, legendary.
Many wrestlers talk
ass
about that,
flappers
too.
Flappers and mm-hmm. stuff like
that. Yeah. And yeah. so apparently one ripped loose when they were filming that, and after that, for like, what, 20 minutes,
yeah.
they couldn't stop getting
could.
The giggles.
Yeah.
And they had to, like, take a break and
yeah.
come back because Carrie couldn't stop, you know.
Just giggling. And like, Rob Reiner, well, what's great about that is Rob Reiner was so patient
yeah.
that he was like, all right, guys. And then eventually.
Yeah.
He's a school teacher.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
a school
yeah.
teacher. Was,
yeah.
All right, kids. All right, all right.
Come
eventually,
on. Yeah.
he called Carrie over and he's like, you know, I know it's funny. We got to get the scene, though. I mean, just look at Andre. If it helps you, look at Andre and think of just how, just.
How hard
think, think about his
be.
Existence and
yeah.
how hard it is and
oh.
how everybody's. Looking
yeah.
at him and watching how he's found so much solace on the set, but how he's just
that's
looked
so
at
thoughtful.
And like
yeah.
and Carrie was like, I instantly stopped laughing, and he's
yeah.
like, I just he's like now is just sad looking at someone who's become my friend who's so sweet
yeah.
and so gentle.
And I think Carrie Ellis apologized to him later.
Yeah,
even I don't get the sense that Reiner meant to like shame his
no,
sister,
no,
trying to help
not.
Him,
mm-hmm. yeah.
help him to like. Changes from mind so they can
yeah.
get
yeah.
the damn
oh,
shit.
For
oh,
for sure.
Yeah. Definitely.
And it's just, but like Carrie felt bad and he told Andre and he's like, it's okay, boss. And like
yeah.
he called everybody boss.
I just
love
that he called everyone boss. Mm-hmm. That he liked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. And then one of my favorites is, in the go, yes, Fezzik. I hope we win.
Yeah.
like
exactly.
Fezzik, you did something right. Don't worry. I won't let it go to my head.
Yeah, I love it.
So great. I love that when after the whole Fassini stuff, when mm-hmm. we come back to Inigo, he's like, all right, Fassini, it's back to the beginning. And he's like, ho there. It's like, oh, what do you say? Like,
no, but you're ho
there.
Ho there,
I'm not to move. Okay. Something like that. And he's like, you brute, help me with this. And it's Fezzik.
Yeah.
And just the look on Inigo's face, he's like, my friend. You know,
he's just like to just. Looking on Jesus Christ as Savior. Like,
yes.
He was so happy.
Exactly.
To see.
That just stuck out to me.
But
like,
just,
it always does.
Yeah, yeah. And what Rob Reiner told Carrie to do, it was so real because that's what Andre the Giant
yeah.
had to... He had to live in a world mm. that wasn't built for people
no.
of his size.
No.
Mm.
And he took it on the chin as well as he could, and he tried to live with a positive attitude.
Yeah, he just had this amazing... That was the thing, is just like... It just everything about him, he wasn't, it didn't, it sounds like across the board, what everyone said about him was like, it's not just that he was generous with his
yeah.
money,
mm-hmm.
which apparently, like, he was notorious for. Nobody was ever allowed to pay if
mm-hmm.
he was around.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so
Schwarzenegger has a story in the documentary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. About trying to pay for dinner for them and how he, like, basically lifted him up and put him where he couldn't get down.
Like a doll.
Schwarzenegger.
Not like Turbo Man
doll. And then goes and pays it. But he also just seemed to have this generous spirit as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so this just so... And like as I was watching the documentary, I was like, gosh, I... Because Brian asked me, he said, now, did Bill Goldman write... Did he know all this about Andre and so write Fezzik to be like Andre? And I was like, I don't think so. The movie was, or the book was written in like 1973.
Yeah.
And so I think... Andre would have been, that would have been his early years in France. He wouldn't have. I don't know. I would have to go back and look at the dates, but I don't think he was at his height.
It's entirely possible it could have been because Andre started wrestling in North America, I think, in 1971.
Yeah.
So he would have been in the territory, but
would William Goldman have known his life story?
Right. Probably. No, yeah. No.
I think maybe physically he would have written Fezzik as Andre from a physical aspect, this landmass is described
and then maybe done a good job of like extrapolating what someone like him would have gone through.
Mm-hmm.
Because the character of Fezzik, there are some differences. So like he was born gigantic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so when you go to read it, it talks about how hard, like, when he was 1 year old, he had a beard and was the size of an 86, like a size of a 12-year-old or whatever. Yeah. Whereas Andre was completely, quote-unquote, normal sized until he hit puberty.
Right.
And then didn't stop growing until he died.
Right. I was going to say, even as he got, even in his old age before he died, he was still growing.
And that's why his body, because your body's not supposed to do that. Yeah. So, like, you see when he was, like, 18, 19, he isn't as big as he was at 40. How old was he died?
46. Yeah.
46.
He's 46, which is super young.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's a little bit of a difference, whereas he would have had a fairly normal young childhood.
Right.
And then all of a sudden this springs up. Mm-hmm. But there's so many things when I was watching the documentary, I was like, but that sounds like, you know, Fezzik.
Yeah.
Like the fact that when he did wrestle on the professional circuit, aside from maybe Hulk or someone else who was also quite gigantic, for the most part, he battled groups because he was so big.
Yeah. 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 Well, and also back to the movie when Fezzik is fighting Wesley, he's like, it's been a while since I've done one-on-one.
That's kind of his fighting big
groups.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gangs for charity. So he's like, it's different when you fight a group than it is one person.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of thing that's emblematic of in the wrestling that world was, when it's like 3-on-1, 4-on-1.
Yeah.
But when you're that, but the reason is when you're that large, people don't like it's not a fair fight.
No.
And so how could he be the bad or the good guy?
Yeah.
If he, and so like, yeah, like, cause he only played a heel right at the end of his career.
For the Hulk Hogan rivalry at WrestleMania 3.
Eventually became a heel. But like,
which he didn't like. And most wrestlers love being heels, and Andre
He was not, he wanted to be the good guy and the one everyone cheered for. Yeah. And I mean, I get that. Like if your whole life, you know, when you look like him, you want people to like you and love you, not, you know, whatever.
Throw
throw shit at you.
Yeah.
So,
and we got a little bit of Inigo's backstory, and we kind of extrapolate a little bit, kind of what we got from that compared to the movie. So, what about Fezzik? Because you had mentioned how when you were watching the Andre doc, you saw so many parallels in a way to Fezzik's backstory and the life Andre had to live.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you have passages?
I do.
For that?
So, I won't start from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. I'll just tell you so. Because he does this funny thing of talking about Turkish women and how they're famous for oversized babies. But Fezzik was small at 15 pounds, but, you know, gained all this weight. And then talks about when he goes to kindergarten and all the kids, once they realized that he wouldn't fight back, bullied him and were horrible to him. And then, you know, he's like at 9, his parents are like, well, you need to learn to fight. Just to protect yourself or to stop, because if they know you can fight, they won't bully you, kind of thing. And so there's this funny bit where his dad's trying to teach him to fight and he can't even, like, he's giant, but he's like swings and misses, and it's just a whole fun thing. And then his dad's like, no, really, you have to hit me. And so he hits him. And then there's this funny bit about, you know, emergency wards and his dad having to have his mouth wired shut and the by the milkman. Back then, people still thought milkman bones.
Yeah, blah, they blah, understood blah, anatomy and all this stuff. And that, and
my way's it's not a joke, very sportsman-like. Or
whatever.
Yeah.
So, in this whole bit where it's like, and then his mom translates, what your father's trying to, because his jaw's wired shut. That's what he says. It's like a Z.
Yeah.
And so they go to that, and then so at 9, so once his dad heals up a bit, they're like, here's what's going to happen now. You're going to be a professional wrestler. 9 years old. He doesn't want to. He's like the most gentle – it was like if Ben was a giant. And we said to him, you're going to have to go fight grown men for money.
Because he's still a little boy.
Because he's still a little
Like the movie Jack.
And a very gentle, spirited little boy that. Fezzik does not want to.
Right.
And he's crying and he's sad. And this is where I stop liking his parents, because they start to like be emotionally manipulative, I think.
Yeah.
So they're basically like, listen, this is what we're doing. And so they train for 3 years. And they start to do this whole thing. And I'll probably hop around a little bit more with this. So they had his first professional match in the village of Sandiki on a steaming hot Sunday. Fezzik's parents had a terrible time getting him into the ring. They were absolutely confident of victory because they had worked very hard. They had taught Fezzik for 3 solid years before they mutually agreed that he was ready. Fezzik's father handled tactics and ring strategy, while his mother was more in charge of diet and training, and they had never been happier. Fezzik had never been more miserable. He was scared and frightened and terrified, all rolled into one. No matter how they reassured him, he refused to enter the arena because he knew something. Even though outside he looked 20, and his mustache was already coming along nicely, inside he was still this 9-year-old who liked rhyming things. So he does rhyme a bunch, and they'll put the rhymes in parentheses. No, he said, I won't, I won't, I won't, and you can't make me. After all we've slaved for these 3 years, his father said. His jaw was almost as good as new now. He'll hurt me, Fezzik said. Life is pain, his mother said. Anybody that says different is selling something. So there's that famous line. Please, I am not ready. I forget the holds, and I am not graceful, and I fall down a lot. It's true. It was, and their only real fear was, were they rushing him? When the going gets tough, the tough get going, Fezzik's mother said. Get going, Fezzik, said his father said. Fezzik stood his ground. Listen, we're not going to threaten you, Fezzik's parents said, more or less together. We all care for each other too much to pull any of that stuff. If you don't want to fight, nobody's going to force you. We'll just leave you alone forever. Fezzik's picture of hell was being alone forever. He had told them that when he was 5. Now, hopefully what they meant was they'll leave him alone about fighting.
Right.
But it sure sounds like to him they're saying, we'll abandon you.
We're going to abandon you,
Which, as he says, this is his picture of hell is being abandoned. They marched into the arena then to face the champion of Sandiki, who had been champion for 11 years, since he was 24. He was very graceful and wide and stood 6 feet in height, only half a foot less than Fezzik. Fezzik didn't stand a chance. He was too clumsy. He kept falling down or getting the holds on backwards, so they weren't holds at all. The champion of Sandiki toyed with him. Fezzik kept getting thrown down or falling down or tumbling down or stumbling down. He always got up and tried again, but the champion of Sandiki was much too fast for him and too clever and much, much too experienced. The crowd laughed and ate baklava and enjoyed the whole spectacle. Until Fezzik got his arms around the champion of Sandiki.
The crowd grew very quiet then. Fezzik lifted him up. No noise. Fezzik squeezed and squeezed. That's enough now, Fezzik's father said. Fezzik laid the other man down. Thank you, he said. You are a wonderful fighter, and I was lucky. The ex-champion of Sandiki kind of grunted. Raise your hands, you're the winner, his mother reminded. Fezzik stood there in the middle of the ring with his hands raised. Boo, said the crowd. Animal, ape, gorilla, boo. They did not linger long in Sandiki. As a matter of fact, it wasn't very safe for them to linger long anywhere. So it goes on to talk about listing the places, boo, and then saying, and then he went to France, went to Asia, and they went, and just some different things like that. This is where he says, I can't help being strong. It's not my fault. I don't even exercise. Mm-hmm. And so it just goes through the different. That's right. Goes through the different places. In Mongolia, his parents died. We've done everything we can for you, Fezzik. Good luck, they said, and they were gone. It was a terrible thing, a plague that swept everything before it. Fezzik would have died too, only naturally he never got sick. Alone, he continued on across the Gobi Desert, hitching rides sometimes with passing caravans, and it was there that he learned how to make them stop booing. Fight groups. It all began in the caravan on the Gobi when the caravan head said, I'll bet my camel drivers can take you. There were only three of them, so Fezzik said, fine. He'd try, and he did, and he won, naturally, and everybody seemed happy. Fezzik was thrilled. He never fought just one person again if it was possible. For a while, he traveled from place to place, battling gangs for local charities, but his business head was never much, and besides, doing things alone was even less appealing to him now that he was into his late teens than it had been before. He joined a traveling circus. All the other performers grumbled at him because they said he was eating more than his share of the food. So he stayed pretty much to himself, except when it came to his work. But then, one night, when Fezzik was just turned 20, he got the shock of his life. The booing was back again. He could not believe it. He had just squeezed a half a dozen men into submission, cracked the heads of a half a dozen more. What did they want from him? The truth was simply this. He had gotten too strong. He would never measure himself, but everybody whispered he must be over 7 feet tall, and he would never step on a scale, but people claimed he weighed 400. And not only that, he was quick now. All the years of experience had made him almost inhuman. He knew all the tricks, could counter all the holds. Animal, ape, gorilla, boo. That night, alone in his tent, Fezzik wept. He was a freak. Speak. He still loved rhymes.
That's good. That's good.
A two-eyed cyclops.
Eye drops.
Like the tears that were dropping now, dropping from his half-closed eyes. By the next morning, he had gotten control of himself. At least, he still had his circus friends around him. That week, the circus fired him. The crowds were booing them now, too, and the fat lady threatened to walk out, and the midgets were fuming, and that was it for Fezzik. This was in the middle of Greenland, and as everybody knows, Greenland then, as now, was the loneliest place on the earth. In Greenland, there is one person for every 20 square miles of real estate. Probably the circus was pretty stupid taking a booking there, but that wasn't the point. The point was that Fezzik was alone, in the loneliest place in the world, just sitting there on a rock watching the circus pull away. He was still sitting there the next day when Vizzini the Sicilian found him. Vizzini flattered him, promised to keep the boos away. Vizzini needed Fezzik, but not half as much as Fezzik needed Vizzini. As long as Vizzini was around, you couldn't be alone. Whatever Vizzini did, Fezzik did, or whatever Vizzini said Fezzik did, and if that meant crushing the head of the man in black, so be it.
I like that.
Yeah, I do too. And it's
plus being a wrestling fan, that makes sense. A wrestling crowd would get, once they get tired of you, they start booing you.
And then as the circus leaves without him, the circus of wrestling, which is carny at its nature, it moves on without him because his body's broken down. And essentially, and this is a part that kind of choked me up when watching it, he died alone in a French hotel.
Tim White.
And Tim White, who just passed away this year.
Yeah.
Was that the guy that was his manager?
Yeah.
Because he was, I was choked up because he was, I mean, the whole thing choked me
like,
up.
There's no crying in wrestling. And he's like trying not to cry. Yeah. But like, it's just, there's so many parallels to, I mean, Andre, of course, he willingly got into wrestling, but it's one of those things where
he won it. He loved it until it didn't love him back anymore.
Which that's tragic, but, like when that happens.
But what Fezzik got from the wrestling crowds, Andre got walking through an airport. The whispers and people like saying things, and he hears all that. And there were more than a few times when he was out and drunk idiots would try to rile him up and like and really and poke at him and antagonize him. And it's just it's like nobody had any decorum
and just
or empathy.
The story in the documentary where on an airplane, like he couldn't fit in the bathrooms.
Yeah.
So they had to pull a curtain. He had to go in a bucket.
Oh, I know.
I was like, God, how? That's humiliating.
Well, and like they were saying, airplanes aren't anything like then. It's even worse then than it would be now.
Oh, And then the travel to Japan so many times of the year, 300 days on the road for someone that's rough on somebody who is 6'4", 250 pounds. Can you imagine someone who's essentially 7'4", 500 pounds?
Yeah. I just can't imagine there was a day in his life after puberty, well, or maybe at least in his adult life.
Yeah.
Gosh, how that he was ever comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Like not physically, emotionally, like, you know, just the thought of knowing that there's nowhere for him to go, really, to be at ease.
Yeah.
Like his farm in North Carolina. And then that's it. That there's nowhere else in the world to really be at ease. Like maybe in the wrestling ring, but as long, that's at the times when he had control over it.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, but still not, because he's still acting and there's still some showmanship and all that. But like to ever, just it pains me to think about him having a life where like, he had to be in pain every day for many years.
That's why he drank so much. Was
And he drank so much because his body couldn't get drunk off anything less.
But it's the same mentality of someone who is out with the intention of maybe getting drunk is to mask the pain.
Oh, yeah. Well,
this was actual physical pain he was masking.
I think it was Cary Elwes that in the documentary said, like, people talk about his you know, jovially speak about his stories of how much he could drink and all that stuff. And it's like, Andre drank because he was in pain.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and you do that much drinking when you can't get, like, he would get drunk, but it took, like,
so
truckloads
much
of things to
and
get him
maybe
drunk.
Maybe it's recency bias, but my favorite part of the documentary was when the 2 or 3 minutes they were talking with the Princess Bride folks because you're not seeing it through the lens of the quote unquote boys in the wrestling business.
Yeah. Wrestling is a cynical, fickle business.
You're not seeing it through promoters. Yeah. You know, you're not seeing it through Vince McMahon. You're not seeing it through wrestling historians. Yeah. You're seeing it through the people who saw him
as he wanted
to be seen, who saw him and accepted him as this gentle giant not to be profited off of, but as this human being with this big smile and these ungodly farts, but like who loved being there and loved being a part of something like that, and who just was so sweet and so kind and just a huge comfort to people.
Yeah.
That's who they saw. So you're not seeing it through a kind of a hazy wrestling view. You're seeing it through people who had no bias towards him as a wrestler.
I love the story to where on the set, It's just frigid outside, mm-hmm. and Robin Wright was just like shaking.
Yes.
And he just, all he does is put his head on top, his hand on top of her head. And his hand was so big, it covered so much of her head that it kept her warm.
It actually helped her to stay warm.
Yeah, exactly.
And then Wallace Shawn was deathly afraid of heights. So when they're going, although the Cliffs of Insanity is the part where they're scaling it mm-hmm. as a set, it's still really high.
Mm-hmm.
So like Wallace Shawn is freaking out, and Andre, same thing, kind of put his head or his hand on his head and was like, don't worry. It's okay,
I'll
boss.
Take care of you.
I'll take care of you. I'll take care of you.
You know, and I was actually this is a little tidbit than when I was rereading the book this last week, but Vizzini, the character Vizzini,
mm-hmm.
has a terror of heights as well.
Mm.
And so there's like this description of him strapped on the front of Fezzik and how terrified he is and all this stuff. And I was like, whoa, that's insane.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. that was like, it was like really the only person that maybe didn't have the best time on the set was Wallace Shawn.
Yeah.
And not, again, not because of the, he even says it's not because of the other people. It's because he was so insecure.
Yeah.
That he just was always worried no matter what, you know, Rob would say, no matter what anyone would say. But also, like you said, he had that terrifying fear of heights. And I was like, oh, wow, that's just so interesting because apparently that was something I hadn't picked up on before, is that, you know,
he did too. It's one of those things that I'm sure that wasn't intentional in the casting, because it's probably not something they would know.
Yeah.
But it is one of those things you're like, of course that they get that detail too.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly.
Like the person that played this character who's afraid of heights is afraid of mm-hmm. heights.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just on this, as you all have probably noticed, this is another bonus episode.
Yeah.
We've had we are at almost 3 hours and 10 minutes of recording.
Yeah.
We have our episode proper, two bonus episodes here, and it's been great. I mean, it's leaving the year mm-hmm. 2022 and something special for New Year's Eve out with a bang.
Yeah.
So glad to have done it. If you're listening to this now, this may be the second or third time you're hearing us. Thanks, Samantha. But again, thank you, Samantha.
Yes.
Also, it's a nice editing point for me.
Yes.
So I know where to cut this.
Yes.
But thank you, Samantha, again for joining us in this particular part of in this particular bonus episode.
Yeah.
Thank you for bringing those passages from the book that we were able
added
to
another dimension.
Yeah.
It gives us more content.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's all about the content.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
I'm just Andre the Giant to you. Is
Yeah, exactly. Just after you leave, it's like, all right, we're not inviting her again. But no, it adds more dimension.
Mm-hmm. Oh, of course.
To an episode.
And it also
for
it's new for us because mm-hmm. hearing those passages, mm-hmm. I'm like, wow. Like, also, it's great. Much more respect to William Goldman for being able to.
It makes me want to read the book.
Yeah,
absolutely should.
Yeah.
Don't if you're gonna read the book, read the book. Don't listen to the supposed audio good parts version.
Yeah,
it's still abridged.
Yeah,
it's more than the movie, but it's way less than. So a lot of my favorite parts from the book are left out of the audiobook abridgment.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you're gonna do it, just do it because there's some really fascinating his framing devices and his anachronisms, and you miss all of that on an audiobook. And on this particular audiobook, they edited a lot of that out.
Yeah.
So I would absolutely like he makes me, because the premise of it real quick is, it's called the Princess Bride, S. Morgenstern's classic tale of the love and high of true love and high adventure. And Goldman's framing device is that, oh, this is just an abridgment of a massive novel written by this great novel, Florinese novelist S. Morgenstern, and his dad read it, and all this stuff. But the way Goldman writes, you desperately want that to be true.
Yeah.
It's not true.
Right.
But I just, every time I read it, even now, I desperately wish that was true.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So you miss all that if you don't have...
Just duly noted. Like, read it. Don't listen to it.
Yeah. And, I mean, We, of course, could have done this for every major character because there's a lot to take from all of it.
Oh,
but
yes. Yeah. There's some fun, like one of my favorite lines in the book is a buttercup line from the beginning. And I mean, there were just so many other things that were in my head that I was like, oh, we'll talk about this and this and this. And we just didn't have time. And and I'm okay with that.
Yeah, sure, of course.
I'm actually really tired.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course. And
this is our second 3-hour recording session in a row.
Oh,
I did
no.
it for the nostalgia episode.
Oh yeah, I know. You guys had a two-parter for that.
Yeah. And then in the episode proper, I think we even send it out by saying there's so much more that I want to do justice to something I love so much and have grown to love even more after all the research we've done and listening to As You Wish by Carrie Elwes. Mm. I want to do it justice, and it's the same here. We say in that at the end, there's so much more we can do, but we did it. We did enough to where it's satisfactory.
Yeah, this is enough.
Yeah, and it definitely is enough. And we never said at the end of episode proper, but it's much like the gentleness of Peter Falk telling Fred Savage, "As You Wish." We'd like to send that your way at the end of this bonus episode. So, like we end every episode. In even bonus episodes.
Yeah. Be good to yourselves. Be good to each other. Because why would you want to be rude when you could be rad? We'll see you next time.